Comrade, welcome. Welcome back from the from recess. May I make the usual request that let us switch our cellular phones off. And by off, I mean off, not silent or vibrate. Just please, can't help it. Let's switch them off. Secondly, we want to welcome our visitors, our guests from the metro of Mangaung in the Free State. Rala Morela, you are welcomed. They are comrades. I'm introducing your visitors to you. I also want you to listen with your eyes. They are led by the chairperson of the Municipal Public Accounts Committee, comrade Ladies Tipenyane. Right there. Thank you very much, comrade. As well as the speaker of council, comrade Mxolisi Siwenzane. Thank you very much, comrades. You are welcomed. Rala Morela. I suppose that beside being here with us, we have made arrangements with our secretariat here to make whatever documentation that you may need available to you. And I hope that all things being equal, we should be able to have some little bit of time at some point today. But we're trying to just sort out those logistics. But you are welcomed anytime. Secondly, we also want to welcome the Auditor General's office, Baba Sanamugela. And comrades, unfortunately today we don't have the accused. So it's a bit of an unusual session. The AG today is occupying the seat of those who always have to come and account. But I would like us to look at this exercise as an enabling process. It will be recalled that in 2008, the Auditor General produced a report requested by SCOPA on government employees doing business with the national departments. I think after the arms deal, it was probably one of the most widely publicized reports, because it laid open the malfeasance wherein officials have become gatekeepers in determining who gets what or how do they share government tenders among themselves, their relatives, their friends, and all that. And comrades will recall that we and then requested the Auditor General to say, after that 2008 report, are we able to go back and say what has been the outcome? Have we seen progress? Have things stagnated? Or have things gone worse? Especially in the light of the ever-rising amounts of irregular expenditure, as well as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. What is the driver of irregular expenditure where we don't follow procedures? Is it self-interest? Is it administrative weaknesses? Or what? This element of conflict of interest is also an important aspect to look at. And it also talks to the ethics of of our civil servants. You know, to what extent are we able to build the kind of civil servant or the kind of administration envisioned in our constitution, the capable state that the NDP is calling upon? How far are we in relation to those? The extent to which we have officials that are honest, law-abiding, follow processes and procedures is a reflection on all these things. So it is on that basis that we have requested the Auditor General to go and make a review, and today they would be giving us their feedback. What did they find? And so we will hand over to the AG. We are friends, we are colleagues, we are comrades in arms against or for good governance. So there's no need to introduce who is here, who is not here. We are always together. So I'll hand over to the Auditor General to give us their presentation. And once they are done, we can then come for any clarity seeking questions. And beyond that, we should be able to say as a committee, how do we take this report forward, the same way we did in 2008. So,
thank you very much, Chairperson, morning honorable members, and also the guests from Mangaung. If I can just quickly introduce myself as well as the team that is accompanying and supporting me. My name is Eugene Zungu. I'm with the Office of the Auditor General, based in Pretoria, and I'm responsible for the audit portfolio, and my title is that of a National Leader Audit Services. With me is my colleague, Barry Wheeler. Barry is one of the corporate executives, also at the Office of the AG. Next to Barry is Fumulani Rabonda. Fumulani is a senior manager in our audit and research department, and he's the specialist amongst others in procurement and areas of compliance, and Sianda is right there at the end of this the line, and I'm sure we all know Sianda is based here in our parliamentary office as a senior manager there. Thank you very much for that introduction and painting the picture, Chairperson. And I think in preparing for this session, we have shared with the members of SCOPA the report or the performance audit report that we issued in 2008. Mm. Also, we've also prepared a briefing document that covers the areas that the chair made reference to, which were the request that were made of us by the committee in terms of enlightening the committee as to what has happened since 2008. But we've also prepared a slide presentation, which is going to be the basis of my presentation this morning, which is really a summary of the briefing document that had accompanied the copy of the 2008 performance audit report. I think without much further ado, I'd like to move straight to slide 3 of our presentation. And slide 3, which is the table of contents. And there's basically 6 areas that we are going to be covering as part of today's presentation. The first will just give the brief background in terms of what we looked at in 2008 when we did the performance audit report. We're also just going to share with the committee at a very high level the summary of the findings when we did the report in 2008 and the recommendations as well as the commitments that were made by our stakeholders at that time. We're going to share with the committee as well in terms of after we had issued the 2008 report, how did we change our approach as the Office of the Auditor General so that we continuously look at this area of conflict of interest. And I think aligned to that, we're also going to reflect and share with the committee our observation of the measures, particularly at the transversal level, that were implemented by government to address the recommendations that we had made in 2008. And we're going to share our findings since 2008, after we had done the work on conflict of interest. We're going to share with the committee the trends that we have observed in the various areas that were of interest to us back in 2008. And lastly, we're going to conclude in terms of what our observations are, and we're going to share with the committee what our recommendations are in terms of taking this process forward. Then if I can then just move to slide 4, that now talks to the background. The background is really about when we did this work when we did this performance audit in 2008, what are the things that we looked at? Firstly, I think it's important to note that we looked, this work covered the transactions for the period 2005-2006 financial year. And in looking at those transactions, we were firstly interested at identifying those employees that were doing business with their own departments, and particularly looking at the ones that had not declared the interest that they had in the businesses that did business with their own departments. We also look at the spouses of the employees that did work with the departments at which those particular employees worked. And also in this instance, we focused in identifying those situations where conflicts were also not declared. The third area that we looked at were instances that employee of departments or the entities owned by the employees of a particular department did work with other national departments. Maybe I must just hasten to add that in terms of today's feedback, we're only going to be focusing on national departments. As an office, we have looked at conflict of interest across all three spheres of government, but our focus today is just to provide this committee in terms of what has happened with national departments since the time that we tabled this report. I think it's important as well in terms of providing the background that there were specific recommendations that we made as the AGSA, and there were specific commitments that were made by relevant stakeholders, amongst which at the time being the National Treasury, represented by the Office of the Accountant General, also DPSA. There were specific issues that they were going to take up and address in terms of the gaps that were identified in 2008, as well as the Public Service Commission also made specific commitments to address the issues. But as well as the specific departments on which we had made these findings, there were specific steps that they had undertaken to address the issues that we had elevated back in 2008. If I can then move to slide 5, where we are now starting to flag what our findings were in the 2008 performance audit report, what our recommendations were, and what are the high level the commitments that were made by the respective departments or those departments that have got that play a coordinating role. The first area that we talk to in slide 5 is that area that talks that looks at where employees have done business with their own departments, but they had not obtained prior approval to perform that remunerative work. In terms of our findings, we had identified that there were 30 employees that we found back in 2008 that had not sought the necessary approval to perform remunerative work. And we found that about 32 million rand was spent on contracts that were awarded to companies that are associated with those employees. There were a number of recommendations that were made in our report, which included, amongst others, that the specific departments needed to take disciplinary action against the affected employees, that going forward, these departments had to implement controls and also to monitor the extent to which employees declare or seek approval to perform remunerative work, as well as to take action in instances where it's been found that that approval hasn't been sought. We further recommended, because in terms of the regulations as they stood when we did this performance audit, it was only designated employees that were required to seek approval for performing remunerative work. We recommended in our report that this requirement needs to be also be extended to the non-designated employees, but also all employees needed to be informed of the requirements for them to declare. There were specific commitments that were made, amongst which we were really aligned to the department saying that they are going to implement the recommendations that we had put forth. If I go to then slide 6, which now starts to look at the second category of issues that we looked at in our performance report of 2008. In this instance, we identified companies or close corporations that are owned by employees, and these companies were found to have done business with the departments, with the national departments where the employee is employed. And such interests were not disclosed in the financial disclosure forms. So these are the issues that we elevated. And in this instance, we found that there were 19 employees that were in breach. And of those, we found that there's about 30.6 million rand that was paid to the companies that are owned by these employees. Here as well, in terms of the recommendations that we put forward, they revolve around the need for the departments to take disciplinary action in terms of those employees that we had identified as part of our work. We also recommended the strengthening of the existing regulations. And also, amongst other recommendations we made, was that the need for new employees that are transferring or that are joining the public service or that are transferring from other departments, the need for them to make disclosures within 30 days of their appointment or transfer. We also recommended that policies needed to be changed, so that it becomes a requirement that employees disclose any potential conflicts within 30 days of any changes in circumstances in their circumstances. We also made a recommendation that that employees needed to be made aware of the need for them to ensure that what was known as CIPRO back then, the CIPC, maintains accurate records of their directorship or membership of closed corporations. In here as well, there were specific commitments that were made, particularly by the by PSC as well as the DPSA. And these commitments revolved around them looking at ways in which they can scrutinize much more closely the completeness of the disclosures that are made by employees in the environment. Also, PSC had also committed to establish rules for the scrutiny of financial disclosure forms. And also, at the time, the DPSA was also investigating the implementation of a financial disclosure form that ensures that even non-designated employees, which were employees at salary levels 1 to 12, would also be required to make this disclosure. Then the third category of findings, that which is in slide 7, that we looked at in 2008, is instances where you had entities that got awards from departments, and where we found that those entities had not declared that they are employees that have got that work for government, that have got an interest in that particular entity. Here as well, we made recommendations in terms of what we believe that National Treasury needed to do in terms of ensuring that in their SPD forms, they ensure that there is more information that needed to be captured on those forms so that we can have a much bigger sense in terms of the interests that go beyond just the employee itself, but those that are closely associated with the employee, whether it's spouses or close family members. What the National Treasury committed to do was to make those revisions to the SPD4 forms, and also to require bidders not only to indicate the directorships that they have in companies, but also requiring the bidders to mention the shareholding that they have. The last area that I'm just going to touch on quite briefly that we looked at, which is also on this slide 7, that we looked at when we did this work back in 2008, was then to look at the extent of SCM non-compliance in instances where we had found these issues of conflict. So what other SCM non-compliance did we observe? Whether it is non-compliance around failure to apply preference points or deviations against other SCM processes. So we found that there were quite a number of instances where there were other SCM non-compliance in terms of where there were instances of conflict of interest. Mm. I think further on in the report, we are also going to show this correlation in terms of the work that we have done since 2010 to date in terms of that correlation. Then the next part that I'm going to deal with in slide 8, it now talks to having done this performance audit in 2008, what is it that we went back and did as the Office of the Auditor General to continuously look at the extent of the issues when it comes to suppliers not appropriately declaring their potential conflicts of interest. So the first part is about, okay, in 2008 we did the performance audit report. Then we started to change our audit approach, where we started to look firstly at the tenders where they were awarded to persons in service of the state or their close family members. We also started to look as part of our normal audit processes at instances where state officials disclose their interest in tenders, whether they have disclosed their interest in tenders or the interest of their close family members. And in terms of how we audit this area, we call it CATS, which is computer assisted audit techniques, which basically is techniques that we use where we are comparing huge volumes of data. So there are three primary sources of data that we look at. We look at PESEL, we look at the CIPC or CIPRO information that looks at the register of companies and their directors, and we look at BES. So what we basically do is that we compare if you've got an employee that sits in PESEL, and you compare whether that employee has got directorships as reflected in the CIPC data. Then once we have found those type of employees that are employed by the state, but they are also having directorships or membership of CCs, then we take that data and we compare to BES to see whether there has been any trading activity between these entities that are associated with the employee concerned, and with whether there's been any trading activity with government, whether their own department or any other department or any other entity within government. So that is the process that we follow to identify these exceptions. Then what we do in terms of the reporting, we highlight all the issues that we have identified once we have made sure that these are definitely exceptions that need to be elevated. We highlight them to management in the management report. But those issues that we believe are material enough, we elevate them to the audit report. But for the last 5 or 6 years, we have included in our general reports a high-level summary of the trends that can be observed in this area of conflict of interest. So that is how we have sharpened our pencils, if you can say, since the issue of this performance audit report. Then in slide 9, I'm just going to talk to our observations as to the measures, and here we are talking the measures that have been implemented at a transversal level, that have been implemented by government to respond to the recommendations that we made in 2008. In 2009-10, we observed that National Treasury issued this practice note 7 of 2009-10, which was really aimed at refining requirements relating to management of conflict of interest in the SCM processes. We saw again during 2015-16, also through National Treasury, where they implemented the Centralized Supplier Database, or CSD, for all organs of state. And what National Treasury does, it's basically similar to what we do when we audit this area, where in their process of including suppliers into this central database, they interface this database with the information from SARS for the tax clearance purposes, information with Home Affairs, also the information with the CIPC companies register, together with PESEL. Then last year, 2016-17, we've seen that the DBSA has promulgated revised public service regulations, which are really at the core of it, prohibiting public servants from doing work with the state or and also they've looked at ways in which they can strengthen the requirements around the process for the approval of additional remunerative work. Then also in 16-17, the DPSA have implemented the e-disclosure system, which is aimed at simplifying the process of annual disclosure of interest. So these are the interventions that, from our point of view, we have observed. Then the next section will now talk to what is it that we have observed in terms of the findings, the audit findings in these areas that were areas of interest when we did the performance audit work in 2008. When you look at slide 11, I think it's quite an important slide, so that we can just get the proper context when we look at the audit findings that I'm going to be sharing with you. I think the first part when we talk about scope exclusions, it's the fact that if you look at the data that sits with CIPC, that data can enable you to identify whether a person is a director of a company. But that data will not enable you to identify the shareholding of a particular company, which basically means that if an employee who was a director of a particular company that had been found to trade with government, then resigned his or her directorship, or even the close family member does the same thing, they resign their directorship, but they still keep the shareholding or the ownership interest in that company, the work that we do will not be able to pick that up. So it will go under the radar. So that is the essence of the exclusion that we have made reference to here in the slide. Also, I think the important point to make is that only up until last year, employees of within the public sector were not prohibited from trading with government or doing business with the state, which is not the case now. So our findings will not elevate all instances where state officials have conducted business with the state. It will only elevate those instances where those officials or the suppliers had not declared their interest. So I think those are the two contexts that I think it's important to make when you look at these findings. Then if you look at slide 12, where we start to show the graphics, the first graphic is really aligned to the work that we did in 2008, where we are now looking at the extent to which employee-related companies are doing business with the national department where that employee is employed. So that's the essence of what this graphic is basically telling us. So you read this from right to left, and we can see with the first graphic that when it did the performance audit report, we had identified that there were 12 departments, or 32% of the departments, where this issue was highlighted as an area of concern. And 10-11, the number was about the same. And then I think the more we focused on this area as part of our audit process, we started to see the decline in terms of the number of departments that were having these findings. As we can see, it dropped to only one department where there were issues that we found in 13-14, and it increased slightly in 14-15 to 2, and then 15-16 to 3 departments. But I'm sure we can all say that it's quite an improvement in relation to what the issues were in 10-11 when we started focusing in this area. Our observation here is that is that departments have taken our recommendations to heart as far as this area of ensuring that the financial interests of their own employees are being monitored, and as can be seen in terms of the findings here. If we look at slide 13, is just a slight variation of the slide that we looked at earlier, where the previous slide was looking at whether the company that is doing business with this department, whether it is owned or it's or the employee that works in that department is a director of that company. This slide 13 or this figure 2 is looking at whether that particular company is it owned by a close family member of the employee that works for the specific department where the company has done business with. And here as well, we can see that back in 2008, we had 12 departments that had findings in this area, which comprised 32%. But we can see that that has declined. We can see the trend in terms of the graphic that is in front of us. It has declined to 3 or 8% in 15-16. And here as well, we have observed that these have largely been brought under control when compared to 2008. Here, I think it's important to flag that the point that I made earlier when I was talking about the scope exclusions, that we cannot discount, without casting any aspersions, we cannot discount the possibility that individuals have resigned as directors of these companies and they only have some kind of a share. But those areas, it's not possible for us to audit. But in terms of what we have here in front of us, we can see that this area has improved quite significantly from where it was in 2008. Then the next slide, which is slide 14. This we did not cover in our 2008 performance audit report, but as we developed our processes in this area, we believe that it's something that we needed to start looking at. And here we are looking at companies that are related to employees of the organs of state that are doing business with other departments. So I'm employed in Department A, and I've got a directorship in Company Z, and I start doing business. My company Z starts to do business with Department B, and my company doesn't declare the fact that it's one of its directors is myself who's employed by Department A. So these are the issues that you are identifying here. So this is the one area that has shown increased findings when you look at the issues of not declaring these interests. Because when we started looking at it, we only started looking at this area in 11-12, and as we can see, we only had 3 departments that had issues, but since then we've had increases of 2 to 5 departments in 12-13 and 13-14, a slight drop to 4 in 14-15, but in terms of our latest work that we did, it's sitting at the highest level ever of 9 or 24% of the departments where we found this issue. What we're picking up is an increase in instances where suppliers will make a declaration of financial interest, but they will make a false declaration. So the supplier will say, I don't have any conflict. But then when we come to do our work, then we identify that there were actually specific conflicts. So that is one of the major contributors to the spike that we're seeing in terms of the increased number of findings in this most recent cycle that we looked at. The next slide, I'm going to try and go through fairly quickly. But here we are now identifying the specific departments, the specific national departments where we had findings. And what we have done, thanks. And what we have done is to also look at the type of audit outcomes each of these departments attained in the years where we had identified issues of conflict of interest. And maybe just to illustrate, because the rest of the three slides are going to work on a similar basis. Maybe let me just illustrate with the one department, so that I can orientate the members as to what we are reporting here. If we were to look at the Department of Correctional Services, basically what, and let's say we look at 2010-11, where there's an amount of 944,392. So what we're basically reporting there is that if you look at all the awards that were made in 10-11 by Department of Correctional Services, where we found that there was no declaration of interest, either in instances where an employee of the department had an interest in that supplier, or in an instance where a close family member of the department had an interest in the supplier, or where there was no declaration of interest in an entity that is owned by an employee of another department that conducted business with the Department of Correctional Services. So all of those awards, when they aggregated, they came to this 944,000 in 10-11. And for that year, this department had qualified audit findings. So you can then see, in terms of the table that we have provided, the departments that have had repeat findings in this area, but also you can see the departments that maybe when we started this process of looking at this area back in 11-12, like the Department of Defense, had significant issues that have put in place some measures to ensure that this is particularly controlled. I can highlight the Department of Defense because we have looked at it in particular, and what we have observed is that while previously they had a decentralized procurement processes in place, they centralized their procurement processes, which then helped them to eliminate this type of issues that were prevalent back in 11-12. Whilst you look at correctional services, it's quite a widespread department where it's quite decentralized, and they may tend to struggle to implement controls that will ensure that these issues are addressed effectively. Then slide 16 is similar basis. We see the various departments that either have continued to struggle, or others that have dealt with it, or the others that are basically emerging. And the same with slide 17 in terms of the specific departments where we found issue. If I then can move to slide 18, where we are now starting to look at the specific nature of findings. Here as well, I'm just going to illustrate and explain it sort of for sort of three different instances, because the rest of the tables work in a similar fashion. So we look at this table 2.1. And table 2.1 is looking at employees of the specific department that are doing business there with their own department. But in looking at this area, we've categorized it into three categories. I'll deal with them in turn. So in this slide 18, this is the first category. This is the instance where the employee has failed to disclose the interest. Okay, in their financial disclosure forms, they failed. They've submitted the form, or but it did not, or the supplier submitted the form, but it did not highlight or elevate the issue that the conflict exists. And this type of instances, we, as the Office of the Auditor General, we are the type of issues that are what we refer to as fraud indicators, because they indicate to us that there is willful intent to deceive, in our view. So these matters we elevate to management, and we recommend to management that they need to investigate these issues thoroughly as to why that particular supplier or employee failed to disclose the interest. So that is the group of findings that we see on slide one. And we can see the number of employees that are affected in terms of each department and the amounts involved. So that's what that table is about. Then table 19, slide 19, it's still looking at employees that are doing business with their own department. But the second category is where the employees or the entity involved did not submit a declaration of interest as part of the bidding process. So they just did not submit the form. And nobody asked the questions as to why we don't have this declaration, and they still went ahead and awarded the tender. So in our view here, the negligence will be much more on the part of the department, because they didn't ask for the form in the first place. The third area here as well is that the supplier did not declare the interest in the submitted declaration. Okay, I think this is the one which is a false declaration. My apology. The first one is the supplier did not submit the declaration form at all, and we still continue to issue the tender. This is the one where the supplier says, "I don't have any conflict," and this is the area that we elevate to management to investigate further. So we've got this one department which we had identified back in 12-13. So this is the nature of how we've analyzed and grouped our findings. Slide 20 is a similar type of feedback, but in this table 2.2, we're looking at close family members of employees that are doing business with own department. And as we can see on this table, in the first grouping where they fail to disclose the interest, we can see the numbers, particularly for correctional services, over the last 5 years. Then supplier provider did not submit a declaration of interest. We can also see in terms of this table, I'm not going to go into the detail, we can deal with it as part of the questions, in terms of the suppliers that have been highlighted. Then slide 21, these are the instances of submitting of a false declaration. You say, "I don't have a conflict," but where the conflict exists. And we've got the number of instances that we can see over the years. Slide 22, it's looking at companies that are related to employees of other organs of state that are doing the business with the department. And here as well, we've categorized them in terms of similar categorization, those that have submitted false declarations. And in slide 23, where they did not submit the form at all, but we went ahead and awarded the tender. I think, Chair, as I come closer to concluding in terms of my briefing, on slide 24, this is where we start to make a comparison between the extent to which a department that has got findings on conflict of interest, the extent to which that we find that department also has SCM findings in other areas. And as we can see that if you look at the 10-11, we had 90% of the departments that had findings in conflict that also had findings in other areas, and 15-16 is at 78%. So what this tells us is that generally in an environment where there's a poor controlled environment around SCM in general, that you'll tend to find that the issues of managing conflict of interest, those departments will struggle to handle those issues effectively. If you look at slide 25, this as well is just a quick comparison that we did between if a department has got findings on conflict of interest, do they generally result in material SCM findings that we end up elevating to the audit report, or do they result in non-material findings? So the yellow part of the bar is only non-material SCM findings that we don't elevate to the audit report. I think this picture gives us, it doesn't give us any firm trend, because the 1 year we only have 29% of departments that have got significant SCM findings that end up in the audit report. But the other year, it goes as far as 67%. So we still include the graph, but it doesn't really give us any specific trend. Slide 26, which is the one area that we looked at in our performance audit report of 2008, is the extent to which employees seek approval to perform additional remunerative work. And what we've seen, we've only looked at this data for 2 years. We don't have the data for the prior years readily available. But we can see that if you look at 15-16 in particular, we see one department that stands out quite significantly, the Department of Police, where we found that there were 181 instances of employees that had not sought approval to do peri-remunerative work. And we also have the Department of Labor at 18. So those are the numbers, and we can see the comparative numbers for 14-15 on the table that we have shared with you. Lastly, Chair, slide 26 is about our conclusion and our recommended way forward. It's our belief that at a transversal level, government has put in measures to try and address the weaknesses that we had identified in the 2008 report. In the detailed briefing, we make a note that these interventions can really only be effective if the departments themselves implement them, and also if where there has been breaches, we can see a very clear case of disciplinary processes being instituted against the affected employees, or appropriate action being taken against suppliers, particularly the ones that give false declaration, which is an area that is a gap, and I think it's an area that even in our general reports we continue to highlight the area of lack of consequences. It's our belief, Chair, that as the committee, you may get additional useful information in terms of the programs that have been implemented by your departments like DPSA, the Office of Chief Procurement Officer, and the Public Service Commission to identify the issues in this area. We've also made a recommendation to the committee that you can also look at the specific departments, particularly the ones that have had repeat findings, which you can see in the slides that I shared with you earlier, to establish as to what measures they've put in place to improve their control environment, and also what have they done to follow up and take the necessary action against the employees or the suppliers concerned. And then lastly, Chair, as the Office of the AG will continue to support the committee in this initiative whenever we are called. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Well, comrades, there we have it. There are two parts to the report. The first one is the part that deals with the that explains and gives context, and then the last part is the part that talks to numbers, statistics, in terms of the amounts and also in terms of the employees that are involved. Would like to thank the Auditor General's Office very much for this report. You have always been there to enable us as a committee to do our work. I've always said that the Auditor General's Office is an enabler. It enables us. It gives information to oversight, and then it's for us to decide what do we do with the information that has been given to us. That points to specific departments. If you look at the figures, you can see that the people who must be arrested actually are the police. If you look at the departments, as well as the Department of Justice and Constitutional Affairs, the very departments that must ensure that the law is enforced are the ones that have gone rogue, you know. But anyway, let me allow you, comrades, to make your inputs. Comrade Kuno, Ross. All right, let me give Comrade Kuno, then we'll go to the Free State again and then come back this way. Yes, no, Comrade Kuno, you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the AG's office for the report. I think, like as you said, Chairperson, the Office of the Auditor General enables us as members of SCOPA to do our job effectively. But I wanted to find out, which is something that I was a question that I was formulating as you were briefing us, that we have more than 34 departments. And I know at some stage when we interacted with Public Service Commission Chairperson, that said to us that it was difficult to actually check data from the directors that to the last level. It was difficult for them to check who is doing business with the state. I'm glad that you said you've had an interaction with Public Service Commission or DPSA through DPSA. And yeah, so I wanted to find out when did they have that improvement. I mean, it's an ideal situation for us to do our job effectively as members of parliament is to see coordination within departments. I mean, you'll find that most of them are doing they're interlapping between the type of duties that they're doing. So it's better if they work together for us to have an effective oversight, because it becomes very difficult. So I wanted to check, because you said that they've then improved in the sense of going from level 12 down to level 1. How is that significant in terms of numbers when you go to your audit findings? But the other thing, Chairperson, what I wanted to find out is that, you know, when you look at tendering processes through all the departments, is it possible, as the Auditor General has said to us, is it possible to actually check all the tender processes if public servants are not doing business with the state? One of the problems that we've always had was that it's easy for anyone to actually check if the husband or the kids are doing, and that's what we declare when we declare, that's what we also declare as members of parliament. But the relatives, it's always difficult to actually check if that declaration or whatever that they've given, if it's true to the core. But I wanted to find out, how do you then help us to make sure that everybody does not get away with murder? I mean, you have just said that others will take off their directorship, but they will still be shareholders of the companies, which is what is happening. But again, and it's good that because of what you have probed as the Office of the Auditor General, that has improved, even though they're still shareholders. But I think we should find ways. I think in the policy that you spoke about, if there are any gaps, because I think we've passed that 2 years ago in Parliament, but sitting down and having to check if that is working, really, we have not done so. So I would also suggest, Chairperson, that maybe it will be good when we, after this term, to have a meeting with the Public Service Commission or DBSA to come and actually see how we tackle these issues together, because I think they're interlapping amongst, and then we need to find a way of seeing how we can help doing things into process as government. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Ross?
Thank you, Chair. Just to align myself with my colleague from the Free State, is the concern that we have with regards to how do we really address this problem. I think it's quite a new field for me.
I hope it's not a Free State concern.
Yes,
it's
a
general concern.
It's a national concern, but there's certainly some Free State concerns, specifically with regards to our municipalities and what the position is in terms of the stats in that regard. Chairperson, how do we deal with the measures and reforms implemented by government to manage the conflict of interest? It seems that the responsibility of finding consequent management goes back to the department itself, and for me that poses a problem, because we actually see the transgressors is the department itself, and perhaps to get responsibility from the companies that they deal with. I think that's another field, you know, it's very difficult. I think we should address the problem within the departments. Now, for me, the problems in the departments is mostly with regards to the supply chain management. I just find that perhaps elevating that to the audit report, is that strong enough, the measures that you take, if I can ask that question to the AG? Is there a specific section in the audit report that you can then highlight these areas where there's this conflict of interest? I haven't seen it in any audit report, not in the municipalities audit report also that I've perused lately. I don't find this specific section as to this conflict of interest within specific departments that we can easily pick it up in an audit report. Is it highlighted strong enough? That is my question. And then secondly, certainly Section 30 of the Public Services Act, if you can just give us a little bit of more information, it's a bit of a vague area for me, what we can use in that regard. And then perhaps lastly, the specific status of the audit reports. I find in your presentation that the status of the audit reports seems to highlight unqualified good findings and then you find huge transgressions in a very good status in terms of the audit report. Let me take an example of correctional services. I think the status of the audit report is unqualified with findings, but we see massive transgressions in terms of conflict of interest and absolutely no consequences in this regard. Should it not play a role in terms of perhaps addressing the status of these audit reports where you find these transgressions and making it easier for us to pick it up in the final analysis within the audit report? Thank you.
Yep.
I'll be coming back down the queue. Thank you, Chair. Now from a much better province, KZN. we play better rugby anyway. Right. Chair, thank you once again. It's great to see everybody again after a bit of a break, and great to see the AG here. Thank you very much. Just a couple of questions directly on your report. I note that you obviously gave us your slide presentation, but then in your explanatory notes here on page 2, you refer to a word which bothers me a bit, and you say sample, and sample is referred to a couple of times. I understand that you do obviously do your work by samples, but the question is, does that indicate that this report is much bigger than it actually is? Is this problem much bigger than it actually is, or is this entire list that you gave us in the departments, is that sample-based, or is that accurate? Is that the full picture? I think that's a question we need to know, because, you know, sample, it's only a sample, it's extremely worrying. Then the other, and I'm not questioning your practice, I understand that's how you have to work. The other question I need to ask is, you've given us the list of departments and the various categories of where employees have transgressed. My understanding is that the... you see, that's Free State trying to sabotage KZN efforts, you see. My understanding is that the Public Service Act has been in play, and this has been a contravention for approximately 2 years now, if I'm not mistaken. Please correct me if I'm wrong. So if you look at the 15-16 findings at least, that's going to be employees that have contravened the Public Service Act, unless I'm wrong. But I remember that when we met in Franschhoek, this had just been passed. It had just become of, you know, it would become in effect in law. So my question is do you have the list of the employees, the list of the bid suppliers, the list of all the persons who have contravened from the 2015-16 year at least? Are you in possession of that? Or do the departments have that? And I'm leading to, can we get any detail, or do you have any detail, as to what's happened to these suppliers, individuals, etc., etc.? Because from that time onwards, they've contravened the law. So we need to investigate whether there's been any sort of action taken against them for their acts. Otherwise, as we all know, the law is a waste of time. So that is really just what I wanted. The sample issue and then the actual action that's been taken. Thank you very much.
Sure. Yes, good evening. Coming to you.
Thanks, Chair. And thank you very much, Auditor General. I just have a few concerns. Number one, my presentation does not have page numbers, but where you are referring to the audit process using the CATS, yeah, and the three systems that inform your CATS, which is the PESAL, the CIPC, and the BAS. These three systems provide you the data where it shows myself. I am employed in Department A in PESAL, you'll get my name there. And when you go to the CIPC where it registers, companies, and my name is not the owner of the company, but I am somewhere featuring in the company. Are you able to pick my name through this system? That's what I wanted to check. And then secondly, a page following that, on the your work on 2016 to 2017, where the DPSA, it shows that DPSA is somehow having systems in place, which is the e-disclosure and the PSR. Are you also referring to the Public Administration Management Act, which prohibits completely all employees of the state to do business with the state? And the provision of additional of approving additional remunerative work doesn't mean that the employee will be working in the state. They will be opening their own business, which has nothing to do with the state. So I heard you during the presentation saying some employees were given approval to have the business with the state, but the PERM Act prohibits them completely. So I take it the approval is just to go and open either a tuck shop or something else that's outside a tender to any kind of business of the state. And then, Chair or Auditor General, please help us with the names of the departments on figure 1, 2, and 3. The figures that do not have names of departments on the graphs. Figure 1, 2, and 3. As much as the decrease is very impressive, but it shows from 2012, 2013, the first figure 1. You find there's 3 departments, the other one is 1. What I want to check is that isn't the same department perhaps a culprit on these figures? If we can get the names of the departments on all 3 figures here, so that we can check if they are not the same correctional services and police when we have to move forward with this. Then lastly, where directors are concerned, I remember very well when then Minister Ramahlodi took to the podium, as it was somewhere in mid-January, where he was warning all directors, all employees of the state that are holding directorship in any company to resign by the 31st of January. And therefore, all audits that still shows after the financial year that ended in March, it means all those that did not resign by the end of January, they are outside the scope of the law altogether, because there is a PERM Act, and then the minister also warned them that they must all resign. If we can get names of those that still held directorships with other states that are doing, or with other companies that are doing business with the state. Thank you.
All right.
No, thanks, Chair. Mine is more on the recommendations that the AG has presented in front of us. But maybe before I talk to the recommendations, I just want to check whether, do you have a mechanism that is to check on these recommendations, whether they have been implemented or not? And if not, what are you suggesting that we do?
I saw your recommendation that is on the last page. That is in terms of us meeting with, that is, these departments. Because obviously, in implementing these recommendations, it might not be that is your office that does that, but obviously it should be the departments that do that implements, that is, these recommendations. And you are indicating also in the summary of 208 performance report findings and recommendations in terms of 30 employees that were involved, and you are saying the amount that was involved was 32 million that was spent. Is it possible for you just to give me or to give us an indication as to, in terms of those employees that were involved, in which departments were those, and in terms of the money spent, how much was recovered, that is, by the state? That also goes to the report performance findings on the employees doing business and government that failed to declare their interest on the financial disclosure, where we are indicating 19 employees and we are saying it was 30.6 million that was involved. Also, the breakdown in terms of those employees, what happened to them, and the money that was recovered.
that is out of the 30.6 that you are referring to. But then the last one, Chair, would be agreeing with my colleague's recommendation that maybe what we need to do as COPPA, we need to make, that is, meet with the department's consent, and particularly the departments that are supposed to deal with this particular issue, the public the Public Service Commission and all those departments. And after getting information from AG in terms of the breakdown of the department, so that we also assist in terms of a follow-up that is on these recommendations.
Okay, Comrade Boy.
We want to thank the Auditor General for doing the work. But also, you see, we need to go back to you again, because you brought this thing to our attention. You wrote in your, the Auditor General, when he came to Parliament and did presentation.
Let's get a little closer to the mic.
Oh, you don't hear me today? Okay, I'll kiss it now. See, when the Auditor General came to Parliament, the way he put the problem, it seems as if it was based on a large scale, which then made us to be suspect to the matter that there's a lot of corruption taking place and fraudulent activities. That's how big was the problem when he presented it. He presented it in a shorter version in his own report. When he was, then that's why we started to raise the matter, because we thought that the Auditor General immediately would be able to not charge, you see, because when you use the statistical approach of sampling, it's fudging now. It doesn't talk to the real issue, you see, that you are looking for, that what is the extent of the problem, you see. I hear this broad political presentation you're making. I want you to be able to tell us that what is the extent of the problem and who are the people that we're talking to. I thought that's where we're going to be starting from, that this is what is happening in Department A, this is how many people who are involved, and this is what is happening. So the questions that are following up there, did you recover the money? Because it's not your job to recover, we should be recovering it as COPPA. Have you given us the details? This is what we are supposed to be doing here. Give us the details of who is involved in this. That was our question, not the broad political explanation you're providing today. I really appreciate it. You have become shrewd politician. But the fact is, give us the facts. Give us exactly in Department A what happened. But as of now, I mean, I do this. These are statistics. This is what your statistics analysis which you are using. But I thought that the day the Auditor General came to Parliament, which was, it has got implications. The implication was that departments are doing business with themselves. Families are exchanging. That's how the Auditor General put it. And I thought that we're working from there on. You finished this political explanation when you left your office. When you come to SCOPPA, you'll be saying to SCOPPA, SCOPPA, in the police, these are the people who are doing this type of thing. And this is what we are supposed to be dealing with. SCOPPA, in correctional service, these are the people, and this is what they are doing. So that the fudging of the report doesn't assist us to exit out of the problem. But SCOPPA must deal with the problem in itself. That what is the nature of the problem, and how do we deal with it? That's what made us to be interested in this. As of now, I'm a little bit amazed. Why do the Auditor General make a turnaround and a turnabout by not naming people who have done this type of scrupulous activity? Because if it was so nice, I don't think we'd even have bothered ourselves to call you to come and explain this nice story to us, you see. We'd have then just said, go and report it in the next session of the Auditor General's report. And then it's a nice story. People are no more, there's no corruption, there's nothing. People are doing a good job. They are complying with the laws of our country. But I thought that the Auditor General, when he raised it himself, was because there is a problem. And you see, it's also amazing that when you call for a report from the Auditor General, you suddenly become selective on this one. You don't want to give us the full run of the departments. You don't want to tell us what is happening in provinces. You don't want to tell us what is happening in local government. I don't know who had then suggested that about 10. But why should you turn around on that one? Because I thought that you would give us, the way the Auditor General has given us, the total state of the thing, so that we could be able to deal with the total state of the thing. That's why, in the scope of you, it was a special area that we need to be able to do and focus upon it, without even, because I'm quite clear that the public service doesn't have the detail of the report that you are providing. And that's what the report we're expecting from. If you are recommending us for us to go look for them, you are misleading us. You see, you must leave us to make the choice and the decision. We want a report from the Auditor General that who is doing business with the department, not the sample of them. Clearly, we want to know who are these people. Are they located in provinces? Are they located in local government? Are they located where? Give us not the summary, the real story. That's what the Auditor General was supposed to be doing today, you see. But because it's you, because the chairperson likes you, I had to be, I'll listen. But at the end of the day, it doesn't reflect honestly what the Auditor General told us on the day he presented this report. It was 2 years back. It's him who brought it. And it would be unfair because, you see, in that general, that's what I cautioned him even then, that the Auditor General, let's not generalize, let us be specific. And give us the specificity that who is doing it, why, in which department. You see, even what they are not even telling us now is even the criteria of exoneration. Who are you exonerating, you see? Because if you are pulling out certain people on the day you were reporting, we were not pulling out any people. We were very clear that there's a corruption. And all these members, out of their eagerness and being very patient to listen to you, started to say, there seems to be a crisis and a problem in government. People are doing business amongst themselves. Let's get to the area itself.
All right.
Now it's a sample today. Statistically a sample,
okay. Means
5 to 10 people. No, I understand, Jefferson, but let me make my point. 5 to 10 people, and it doesn't talk to the real numbers and the depth of the problem. That's what we are interested in. How big is the problem? And be honest to us, Auditor General. Be fair to us. Give us the facts. How many people are involved in this thing?
Right. I'm sure that all members have been noting the questions. I allowed everyone to, so that you're ventilating. Okay, no, that's fine. Let's hand over to the Auditor General. I think some of the observations that I had have been raised. If there's anything that will be outstanding, I think we'll tie it down and we can have an early day. Today. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair, and to the members for the questions. I'll deal with them in turn, and in the instances where I need my colleagues to chip in, I'll direct the question. Patrick, I think you just need to be ready from Lani, particularly the ones that talk to insights in terms of the acts themselves, particularly in that regulation 20 or section 30 of the PSA. But I'll try to deal with as many of them as possible. I think on the question of the disclosure of interest and the 11-12-1, I think what I'm going to do, because I'm presuming all the members have got the actual briefing document that we had prepared. So that some of my answers, I'm going to be referring to the document in terms of just pointing out where we've dealt with some of the matters. I think when it comes to the levels 12-1 or levels 1-12, we deal with that matter on page 2 of the briefing document, which is the issue around the financial disclosure. because back in at the time that we did this work in 2008.
I think what particular sisters, if you're referring to any page in the presentation,
okay.
Maybe let's just talk to the heading, because I don't see the numbering.
Yeah, I think Chair.
Which one?
Send. Elena, it's a bit for this.
Yeah. All right, okay. Do all of the members have got this document here? No, that is the report itself.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, but there's a briefing document, right. A Word document that looks like this.
Okay.
No, that's a presentation.
All right, no, that's fine. If you're referring to that one, yes, it does have pages.
All right.
Yeah. Continue.
Okay. All right. I'm sure the copies are going to be are going to be arranged. Well, I think it's going to be easier because it's got page numbers. Otherwise, I'm going to lose you on the slides because the information is largely similar.
Okay.
So yeah, the issue of disclosure of interest. Because at the time that you did the report in 2008, it was only the designated employees that were required to make the disclosure of financial interest. So our recommendation at the time was that this requirement must extend to all the employees, and which that was implemented from then subsequently. Yes. All right, okay. So it's one of the recommendations that haven't yet been implemented, where we're saying that this disclosure has to cover all the levels, not only just the designated employees. In terms of the relatives, is it difficult for us to check in terms of the relatives that are doing business with the state, and how do we close the gap? In terms of, because even in our report we talk about close family members, which basically will be the spouse and the children, because that is the information that we can get from PESAL, or we can also get from the specific employee records. But if you widen the circle between those close family members, even ourselves, we can't pick that up. We don't have the ability to pick up the wider circle of relatives. So that those insights we can't offer in terms of the work that we do. And I don't think at the moment it's possible for us to close the gaps. I think it's something that we can look at if we are aware of it. But in terms of
Are you saying so that when you say the Madiba clan, you're not able to pick up? I just want to get clarity. Because if I say it's the Madiba clan, how close is that to the family and how far is that from you in your ability to be able to check those companies?
Thanks. If I can make an example, let me use the Zulu clan, the Manzini clan, because I'm closer to that clan. I'm that clan. in essence, if I was being audited as part of the work that we do, the close family members that can be picked up is in terms of my direct dependencies, which would be my children, because that's the information that will sit in my personnel file. And my spouse or spouses, so your spouse in this regard, because that information will be either in our HR records or somewhere in the HR information. My brother, my cousins, that information we can't pick up. Okay, so I hope it clarifies it.
Okay,
sure. So those are the limitations in terms of the work that we can do, and that the work that we do. In terms of the in terms of elevating these issues to the audit report, so in terms of how we report, honourable member, is that what we elevate to the audit report, it depends on the materiality of the issue that we identified. If, for example, in a particular department, if I can just make an example, we find that there's only one instance, or there's one employee, or there's one supplier, where we have identified that there hasn't been declaration of this potential conflict of interest, that matter will only find itself in the management report that we share with the management of the department concerned, but we will not elevate it into the audit report because we won't be identifying it as material. We won't be saying that this issue is that significant in relation to the department that we audit. But then, yeah, definitely, when the matters are elevated into the audit report, we will be making reference to the specific regulations that have been breached. So if you were to want to see whether it's related to the conflict of interest, you will have to have awareness of the regulations, whether the treasury regulations or the public service regulations that are related to the issues of conflict of interest, and we will specify it. But in addition to that, we also elevate these matters in the general report, which is slightly more can be much more consolidated and possibly slightly more digestible, because it becomes very specific, and the categorization of the issues they are grouped in a nice way in which members of parliament or members of this committee can be able to interact with that information. So those are the various places where you can find our reporting on this on this matter. I think the question of session 30 just noted from Lani. We'll get back to it, so we can just be ready to respond to it. There was a question around the status of the audit report, that when we compare these departments and you look at their audit reports, they are unqualified with findings. I think it's important to note that if again we look at the table on page 7 of our briefing document, where this comparison of the audit outcomes of the departments that had these issues of conflict of interest not being declared, none of them are green. So it means that none of them are clean, which basically means that each one of these departments had findings. And these findings would have been at least be compliance findings. It means that even though these departments can produce an unqualified set of financial statements, there are underlying issues in their control environment which causes them not to be able to handle the issues of either supply chain management or other compliance related matters. So that's why it's important that we always try to flag the issues of unqualified with findings as much as it can be celebrated, but at times in the process of celebrating it, we can lose sight with what sits under other findings. So these are the type of things that you end up finding in the other findings. Then there was a question around the sampling. I think in terms of the bulk of the information that informs this report that I'm sharing with the committee today, this information has not been derived as a result of sampling. I did indicate that in terms of how we conduct this audit, we do a comparison of mainly these three databases, being PESEL and being the information that sits at CIPRO, being the information that sits in BAS. Because of the use of CATS, or the computer assisted auditing techniques, we are able to audit that database 100%. So we can be able to go through that database and pick up all of those exceptions, or all of those instances where if you match the two databases, you find some commonality, right? So that is not informed by sampling. But the other areas, when you're now auditing the sort of the general tendering process or the tender, the adherence to SCM in general, that can't be audited in any other way other than sampling, which is where we refer to sampling in our report. If I also can refer to the briefing document to the bottom of page 2, because this is where we are now looking at the wider contracting and the tendering process. We can't audit that 100%. It's not possible in that environment where there are so many tenders that are issued, and it's a normal and an accepted practice that auditors sample. And it's a matter of how you do it in a manner that you limit and you manage the risks of arriving at an incorrect audit opinion. All right, so there's the question of the, in terms of our report, that we're still showing employees that are still trading with government, even up to 15-16, which might be seen as a period after the implementation of the of PEM. My understanding, but from Lani, you can correct me when you provide your input as well, is what we've captured on page 5 of our briefing document, where our understanding is that the regulations are only becoming effective 1 August 2016. And what we are reporting here, the most recent in terms of the findings that you are sharing with you, when we refer to 15-16, this is the period ending March 2016. So this would have been before the promulgation of these regulations. And I think it's the point that you also make in the report that says post 15-16 or post August 2016, state officials won't be permitted to trade with government. So if there are those instances, will then be where they're still trading, whether it's declared or not, we will elevate and highlight it in our future reports. The list of employees and what has happened to these suppliers. I think in terms of the list of employees, particularly in terms of the findings that we start summarizing from page 8 of briefing document, because there you can see, for example, we do make an indication as to the number of employees that were involved. You look at correctional services, we say in 12-13 there were 14 employees. So we've got this information, it is in our files. And maybe to touch on to what Honorable Boy raised, is that we didn't understand today as us coming with this specific information, but if the committee requires of the information, we can provide it in respect of those specific departments where you are of particular interest. So we can provide the list of employees in terms of this question that is posed here. What has happened to these suppliers? We can't answer that question necessarily in terms of each of the specific cases, which is where we recommend that the committee can then sit with the specific departments. Because whilst, as part of our audit process, we do look at consequence management, we do look at whether, after we had raised an issue of non-compliance with SCM, for example, do the departments conduct investigations? Are there any consequences, or do they have processes in place to conduct consequences? That we're looking at generally in terms of what happens within the department. It's not designed to track a specific case that this employee was, that did that happen. It's not how we've designed our audit processes. So I'm sure that once you have insights in terms of the employees or suppliers concerned in terms of what we found, then the answers should be forthcoming in my view, respectfully, from the department's concerned. Then there's a question I've noted here on, are we able to, oh my God, my handwriting. are you able to pick up names of people, not directors of company, yeah, when we use the systems and we compare what sits in PASELV and what sits in CIPRO or in CIPC. I indicated in my presentation that the limitations of the work that we do is the fact that if a person is not a director of a company, is employed by the company, is a shareholder, we won't pick it up. Just, I think, to be absolutely straightforward, we won't pick that up. We only pick it up in the instances where the person is a director, or we, by chance, we find that they are a shareholder and they're still employed by the state. But the thing that we can say with certainty is if a person is a director, because that information does exist, and when we can check it. From land, you need to deal with the one that also reference to the PEM Act prohibiting trading with the. I think I've touched on it briefly, but yeah, you can just enhance that. Okay, and there was also a request of the names that are still holding directorships, even though the minister has announced that they should cease. So we won't have this information now because we're still busy with the auditing of the 16-17 cycle. I'm sure that information will be available once we report for this cycle of 16-17. There's a recommendation about the extent to which departments have implemented our recommendations, or if I'm reading this correctly, or whether we've got mechanisms to check whether recommendations have been implemented. As I think I've indicated that we can check in general whether departments are implementing recommendations, but I can't say for certain that specific disciplinary case that was going to be undertaken for that specific employee. And I think I have mentioned that we'll be happy once SCOPA does indicate in writing which departments they want specific details. And in terms of our PA Act, Section 50, we need to get permission from the AG, but I think that's the process we have to follow. But I think as an office, we are amenable to sharing the information that we basically have. Oh, there was a question about 2008 findings. Who were these departments? And here as well, we had included for the members the PAA report of 2008, which is the other one that the members were showing, this one here. And I think if the members can, then there's three annexures at the back of this report, annexure A, B, and C, where we had indicated the specific departments where there were findings back in 2008. And I'm sure, and this as well, if there's interest in a specific department, I'm sure we can be able to extract the information and provide to the members. In terms, I think I've dealt with some of the questions from Honorable Boy in terms of the briefing that we got for today's session was that SCOPA is interested in what has happened to national departments. Because when we did this performance audit, we looked at national departments, we looked at each provincial departments. We look at provincial departments at each province. So that's why we've confined our briefing today just on national departments. But I think the member can rest assured that the insights that we have given in terms of the further work that we have done as an office and at national departments, the same type of work has been done at provinces. And we've also extended it to local government, but it's just for today we've only confined the feedback on departments. All right, I think if you can just deal with the questions that I left for you from Lan, and then we'll just see if there are any other follow-up questions from the members.
Thank you, Eugene. Good morning, honorable members. Starting with the question on the VAG information and on paragraph, Section 30 of the Public Service Act. If you look at Section J, which is on paragraph on page 13 of the briefing document that we have, that is where we are highlighting the number of instances or number of employees that we have identified that they are doing business with the state, but they did not have approval to perform on remunerative work for the past 2 years. What we're trying to say there is that the Public Service Act, Section 30, as it is currently, it was not clear in terms of what is meant by performing work. And at that point, when we performance audit was doing this work in 2008, there was that lack of clarity. We also, through our own processes, obtained legal opinion, which tells us that there's lack of clarity as well to say, does holding a directorship indicate that somebody is doing work, or conclusively say this one is performing work? And that also, we couldn't really conclude. So what we decided to do is that we don't discard these findings. We report them to management of the institution concerned for them to investigate, because this becomes an allegation of possible contravention or possible financial misconduct. Must investigate. So that's what these instances that we see there, 2015, 2016, this is what we report to management. Say, go and investigate. Next year when you come back, we will ask you questions, what have you done about those investigations. That's what we're saying. The good thing now is that starting from the 2016-17 financial year, the one that we are currently auditing now, which we don't have fundings yet, the DPSA has clarified to us that holding a directorship amounts to performing work, because in terms of the Companies Act, as a director, there is a minimum work that you are required to do. So you cannot say I'm a director and I'm not performing work. That is not, doesn't work. So at least now, post this information that we have now, we will be able to say now these people have contravened or they've been contravened. That is that's what we're trying to say now on that first question on Section 30 of the Public Service Act. With regard to the implementation of the PEM Act and also the new revised public service regulation, Eugene is right that the implementation date is 1 August 2016. Just to marry the two, the Public Administration Act was signed by the President for as an act, I think, at the beginning of last year. But it did not indicate the implementation date in terms of when does it become effective. So it's an act, but nobody knows when does it become effective. He left that power to DPSA to promulgate sections of the act bit by bit through regulations. That is why DPSA say, okay, now we have got the capacity to work on this one, let's implement this one. So they are not going to have a big bang approach by bringing the entire act into play, but section bit by bit. That's what they are doing right now. And that is why in July last year, they revised the public service regulations, which will be effective 1 August 2016. And what their regulations say with regard to what we're talking about today is that no public servant is allowed to do business with the state. And the public service, we're talking about employees of departments, provincial, national. It doesn't cover municipal employees, doesn't cover public entity employees. But when we talk about business with the state, they're talking about any organ of state across all three spheres of government. So that meant that from 1 August, no new tenders can be awarded to a state employee. If that happens, then that employee who's receiving the tender is contravening the public service regulations. But it then provided the, as we indicated on the in paragraph. So which page was that? Page 5, at the top of page 5, paragraph 3. We indicated the transitional provisions to say when the regulations are coming into play, there are already those employees who have tenders with the government. What do we do with those? And they were given a staggered approach to say, by this date you must have disclosed that to your exit authority. By this date, you must have then made a decision to dispose of that interest. By that we mean, by 31 January 2017, which is the current year now, which we're still auditing, you must the affected employee must have either resigned from the state, or resigned from the company where they're holding that interest, or have cancelled the tender they have with the state. Right now, we do not have that information because we're still busy with the audit. The information will only be available post 31 July when we are done with our audit. So the and then just to expand further on what Eugene tied on with regard to the limitations that we have with regard to identifying the shareholding where there is no directorship. So somebody is just a shareholder but not a director. We are hoping that the new reform that has been implemented by National Treasury, the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, will help us in this regard. Because when you are registering as a supplier of government in that central supply database, you are not only required to document the information of the directors, but that of the shareholders. So we are hoping that that information will then be useful in terms of helping us to identify whether this person is a state or not, because that system also interfaces at shareholder level whether this shareholder is working somewhere in the state. And we are hoping that as times go, that will help to bridge the gap between the lack of information at CIPC and what we need to achieve in this regard. I think I've covered what you've left for me, Eugene. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah,
no, it's fine. I'll come back to you. I just have 2 points that are of interest to me arising from your presentation. Employees are not allowed to do business with the state. Does it say the state or the department?
It says the state. We even had meetings with the DPSA to clarify in this regard.
All
they
right.
say the state.
Right. Who is the state? Or what is the state? Let me assist you. Is the state limited to departments, or does it also include the entities in the departments? So, ESCOM.
They expanded the definition to cover all three spheres of government. So basically when we are auditing, just to...
I'm talking about an entity, like a parastatus, or the sphere of government.
Yeah.
Does it include parastatus
yes.
as well?
Yes.
Now, what is an employee? At what point do we say you are an employee, you are not an employee?
Okay.
An advisor to a minister, is that an employee or not?
Here we're talking about a provision of the Public Service Act, which only applies to those who are appointed in terms of the Public Service Act. So we're talking about only people who will be classified that definition of public servants within the Public Service Act. So the advisors, in this case, I don't think they're appointed through the Public Service Act.
All right. No, that's fine. You have a follow-up? Follow-up? No, you just spoke first.
Yeah. You see, the Auditor General, you said there's 48 billion of irregular expenditure, and this became part of the figures of people doing partly business with government. How do you get out of that? Because that's the impression that was created. And that's why we kept on asking this question, that what is the magnitude and what amount are we talking about? And that's why we're interested in the details of that relationship, because it seems as if these are huge amounts and they were coming. That's the impression that was created. With this new interpretation and the new explanation that you are providing, in monetary terms, you are not telling us how much it is. You see, that's why it's important that you should leave it with Parliament to deal with the matter. Because one, there's no consequences. Two, in monetary terms, it doesn't explain how much are we talking about that government have lost and that has been recovered. I respect your explanation. It's a well-educated explanation, but to the ordinary people who are listening to your presentation the day you came to Parliament, it doesn't make sense. We want to know how much money has been brought back to government through all the other mechanisms and the reductions that they are talking to.
Right. Okay.
Thanks, Chairperson. I agree with my colleague
You know, when the president talked about this for the first time, we're all concerned. It was like a big problem that we're having within the public service employees, or we can call them whatever, yeah. But, you know, in your indication, you know, explaining or taking out or explaining everything that was said, when you look at that public service regulation that he's talking about, I think the information that he's giving us is not the information that we've heard throughout the years, Chairperson. I think that's why it's important for us to have a meeting between the AG's office and Department of Public Service and Administration. Because, I mean, your question was interesting, Chairperson, to say that who is then an employee? How do you categorize your DG, Director General, the Deputy Director General? Who are the real role players? Who are the real cultures who are doing all these things that we're talking about? And the amount that you have, I mean, if I just calculated roughly, Chairperson, I think it's less than 30 employees who are doing business with the state. So according to you, Eugene, is this a serious problem? Is it something that we can say as COPPA we need to deal with up to the core and see who are these people, so that when we talk about consequence management, we can deal with, we can make sure that it's dealt with in the department with the problems that it deserves? Because, I mean, the way you have simplified it, the 32 million that you spoke about, that that pertains to the employees who are doing government with the who are doing business with the government. It's too simplified. I mean, we're not sure as COPPA members what do we do after this, because, you know, Mente asked a question earlier on, and she said, I don't think it was Mente. But who's really exonerated as in that election? Because I know that you can get permission from the executive authority for you to do this. That's what it, I mean, when we dealt with that bill from the beginning, there were those problems that we that the Public Service Commission was having a problem with in the first place, to try and see how they can interpret that in an everyday work. That's why it was difficult for them to actually take those employees from directorship, from being directors to the level one grade. It was difficult for them because they could not interpret that law into what you are saying right now. But I agree with what you are saying. If that is implemented, and it means that everybody who's working with the state cannot do business with government, then you are not talking to the public entities. Day in, day out in the media, and when you look at different departments, with what you have reported today and what the information that we've had throughout, you know, when we interrogate different departments, it's not the same information that we are getting from you today. So that's why it's a serious concern. We don't know if we should run with this as COPPA, or is it not, it's not a real concern. Let us wait for the promulgation of the Act, which will be in effect after August. Or what should we do right now? I mean, with the information that you have given us, we want to work and make sure that we root out corruption in South Africa. The other problems that we have as far as SCM is concerned is that people are not paid per 30 days, and you find that they are not paid because you find that public servants don't have interest in those people being paid because they didn't have that particular tender that they wanted. And it's a serious problem, more than what we have simplified today. I don't know if you understand what I'm trying to say, Chairperson, but we need to get into if this is a real corruption that we're talking about, how do you help us, you know, as members of parliament, to make sure that we run with this thing and we root out corruption together? Thanks, Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. once again, thank you for the report, but it just occurs to me that with the provisions only kicking in August last year, effectively this no one on that list is falling foul of any law. I think that's correct. So effectively this has been a very interesting academic exercise to tell us who the known persons are who are dealing with the state that are either working for the state or related to people in the state. So effectively there's nothing, colleagues, that we can really do with this report in terms of having a list that we can insist on disciplinary action, because they've actually done nothing wrong in terms of the law. But so my follow-up question then is the AG ready with this database of people that you know in the last financial period were in business? Are you ready with that so that when you do your report for 16-17, you can say, they're still there, and we pick them up? Because now you have sort of, I don't want to call them suspects because they've done nothing wrong in terms of the law. But are you going to keep an eye on these employees, these persons listed in the report you've given us for next year? And then will you be able to give us a report on that when you're over and above your normal audit reports that you present, I think, in November this year? Will you be able to, at that stage, say, okay, we've had this engagement in May, here is now a report that actually we can do something with? And that will refer to people after 1 August last year, and then my Honourable Mentor referred to people who had the chance to resign by, I think, the 31st of January this year, and pick that up. So that's just our question. Are we ready to go to pick up those people? Thank you.
Right. Yes. Okay, then Ross. No, her first.
Thanks, Chair. Chairperson, if we read the tables that are provided in the other report, which was emailed to us, which is more similar to the presentation where he's reading from, it provides information for 2014-15 and 15-16. And to me, it tells us that even if the PEM Act was not effective by the time, there's still corruption, because it also affects the findings that we find on these departments. As he was saying, none of them are on the green. And most of them, if you read on the 2008 report, most of them, they are issued these tenders irregularly. There would be certificate not requested, disclosure, documents not supplied. Even with the e-disclosure system in the DPSA, the last meeting I attended with the DPSA committee, the e-disclosure system is not 100%. The officials themselves do not disclose. We took on the officials of DPME. They were more like at 70-something percent on disclosing. So that system on its own is not assisting, and therefore it means we can unearth a lot more, even without considering the fact that they are prohibited by the law now. Prior, the August 2016 of the PEM Act, there were irregularities. If you would have to consider the SCM, the PFMA, the Municipal Financial Management Act as well, and the triple PFA. In the 2008 report that the Auditor General has given us, it's very clear on how these tenders were given out. Sorry, Chair, this is where I'm reading the emails from. I don't know what I pressed now. So with all these reports, we cannot rule out the corruption and perhaps say, no, this is not where we find a lot of corruption within the department. As much as today's presentation is on national, 39 people is a lot of them. Because the amount of money being paid out to them alone, not including provinces and municipalities, is quite too much.
It's a huge sum of amount, and it has to be accounted for. So we can use this information, and we, if the Auditor General can assist us with the names, with the departments, and break down, because on his, I think it's page 12 on the other one, there is just, it shows how many employees per department, but who are those employees per department that have been issued tenders irregular. Thank you.
Chairperson, just a quick follow-up, and thank you to the Auditor General in terms of his reply and making the awareness and transparency as to the conflict of interest. But I still have a problem. In terms, just to see if I've just missed the point where I can pick it up in the financial statements. I think I did miss it. But you mentioned that it's highlighted in the management report, either to the departments or to municipalities. And it's, now, unfortunately, we don't have privy to that management report. That is... the conflict of interest, I think, should be highlighted in the management report. But you then mentioned that that I can find it, it is elevated to another mechanism. Could you just perhaps give me more clarity in terms of that?
Right. So we can close the matter for today. Let me hand over to the Auditor General.
Thanks once again, Chair and Honourable Members. I think I'll also deal with the questions in order. The first one around the link between what we're reporting here and the 48 billion rand irregular expenditure and what are the amounts involved in terms of this area of conflict of interest. I think if I can just draw the attention of the members in terms of where we have made mention of the amounts in the report. It's both in the slide, but as I said, I'm just working from the briefing document because of ease of reference with the page numbers. Because when you look on page 7, starting from the bottom of page 7, this is where we have indicated these instances where officials or employees have conducted business with the state. I think maybe just to respond what is related to a later question from an honourable member that says there hasn't been any law that has been broken. There's actually been law that has been broken because these employees were supposed to declare these conflicts, but they did not declare them. We made the point earlier as well in our presentation that to say this is not the full extent of the business that employees of the state or their close relatives or close family members have conducted with the state. We're only reporting those instances in terms of the previous regulations that were applicable where there hasn't been any declaration of the interest or there has been false declaration. I think I need to make that point. So we're showing the numbers here. As we can see, if you look at the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, we've got figures of 5.9 in 15-16, 14-15 in 14-15, and so on, 6.8 million in 13-14. And we're going to show in our later tables in terms of how many employees have been involved in respect of each one of these departments. The amounts are shown there. Then in terms of the relationship to the irregular expenditure figure that we have reported in our latest general report, the point that we make on page 12 of the briefing document, where we're saying that of all of these, for most of the departments where there is conflict of interest, which is the top graph, we are finding that there are other SCM non-compliance, because that figure of 48 billion rand is being driven by an environment where there is non-compliance with supply chain management. So that's the point that we're trying to make, that in most instances, there is a correlationship between departments that are not managing the issue of employees declaring or checking appropriately before they award the tenders. There's a relationship between that and the general concern with the internal control environment that is supposed to regulate the procurement process. So that is the relationship that we believe it's important for us to highlight, and we believe it's quite an important relationship. And for us as auditors, it's something that is of concern, and we'd like to think that it will also be of concern to this committee. How much has the government lost as a result of conflict of interest? That's always a complicated question, because if we still go back to that table that is on page 7 that I made reference to, an argument can be made that if you say that the 5 point, I still stick to justice and constitutional development, we say 5.9 million rand was awarded in instances where conflicts were not declared. How much did government lose? One cannot say for certain. We have given context in our previous general reports where we've said in most instances we can see that services have been delivered. Most probably if you go to this department, you may find that services have been delivered, but or goods have been delivered. But we always say that we can never be certain whether government has gotten value for money if there are instances where you are highlighting concerns as to how the procurement process has been conducted. And to quantify that, sitting here, it's impossible for us to do, which is why we always urge that when we flag these issues, then in terms of the departments concerned, in terms of the structures that need to hold those departments accountable, where the investigations need to take place to now get into the nub of the issues. What has driven this department where they know there is conflict, where they know that interests have not been declared, but still I go ahead and award the tender. Or I know afterwards that this supplier gave me incorrect declaration, but I still don't take any specific action. What are these thought processes that are driving this type of abnormal, at least sitting here, behavior? So that's where an investigation and an audit is not going to, with all the respect, is not going to provide those answers. The audit will flag that there is a concern here. Somebody with a different set of skills must then go and do the thorough investigation and see what other interests or what other relationships have been served through this non-adherence of what could be seen as a very a basic compliance requirement. So that's really the plea from my side, and I firmly believe what is being highlighted is of particular importance and should be of particular interest to the committee. In terms of the questions of is this a serious problem, I think I've addressed it, because we also work with trends. We've got departments here. Look at correctional services, if I can mention them. Each and every year there are findings around conflict of interest. Are the numbers significant? I'm sure it depends on where you sit, but from the point of view of the country, I think these numbers are material to warrant a closer look. And what is it that is happening within this department, if I can look at it, that is causing it just not to be able to implement these requirements for the declarations of conflict of interest? Should focus. I think I've spoken in terms of my view. These are my personal views, whether SCOPA should focus. We have been reporting very consistently about the lack of consequence management as the office. I think that is in the public domain. And this is at a very sort of localized scale. This is this is a sort of a microcosm of that. We can see it in action, where we're seeing lack of consequence management, where which has now resulted in some of these departments not being able to get out of this non-compliance. So the question is, now with the stricter rules that are going to apply from August 2016, what type of numbers are we going to start reporting in these departments? I think we will start to see that from this year onwards. Who exactly is exonerated? I hope I fully understand the question. If I don't, I'm sure the members will follow up on that. But we did indicate earlier that levels 1 to 12 from Lane are not part of what is referred to as designated employees, which basically means that they are not required to declare their interest. But all of that I think it no longer applies now with the new regulations. So those employees at level 1 to 2 would have featured in our findings, because they're not required to. Yeah.
Just to clarify, from the point of the public service regulations, annual declaration of interest, that's what they'll need to feature. But from the SCM processes, they need to feature. So if I'm working in a department and I have a role to play in SCM, I must declare my interest, whether I'm a security guard or what, as long as I've got closer look into the processes.
Okay, I think on the question of the information not being the same as from the other departments, if possible, if the committee can share where they're seeing the differences, so that we can understand whether we are talking to the same type of information. But again, in terms of the brief that we had for this meeting, was to say in 2008, we as the AGSA tabled a performance audit report that was looking at this specific issues. So what has happened since? So and hence the areas that we've looked at, because if you look at the 2008 report, there's close alignment to what we are briefing the committee on. But yeah, it will be of interest to us to be pointed out in the right direction if you believe that there are differences. But the information that we've included here is what we've reported to the respective departments in terms of their management reports that we've shared with them. In terms of assisting you in terms of rooting out corruption, I have flagged in my report specific instances that are of specific concern to us. For example, where we have found that there has been false declaration on the side of suppliers or of employees, and we flag that as a fraud risk indicator. It's something that says most probably it's somebody who was intent on circumventing the controls that are out there, and which is something that could be a precursor to a corrupt behavior that is happening within that specific department. So those will be the instances, in my view, that are highlighted in this report that should be of interest to the committee. I've mentioned the one that says, why does the department continue to have the same finding? Do we have any evidence that they are taking action against suppliers? I can't make a blanket statement here and say this department hasn't, which is why we're recommending for those that are of specific interest, and SCOPA can call them in. But in our general report, again, we have said generally in the environment that we audit, we are seeing lack of consequences. And what is it that is driving that type of behavior? Is it corruption? It's possible something that the committee, in my view, we may want to have a look at closely. I'm making a case in terms of how important the issues that we are putting forward to the committee are from our point of view. We simplify the problem. I don't believe that, because as I've indicated, that we've continued along the lines that we started in 2008, and we've been quite consistent in terms of following up what is happening in the environment in relation to the issues that were flagged then, and we've even added some other elements that have been informed by our observation with the environment. So I don't believe that we have simplified the problem, and but yeah, if there is further information that is required by this committee, we are happy to share it with them, with yourselves, honourable members. Foul of any law. Okay, so I've dealt with the foul of any law. Okay, in terms of the database, I think the database of employees that are doing work with the state, we are going to start reporting on that when we report from 16-17, and I'm sure that information can also be made available.
Yeah, which part?
The money part of it, how much is it costing us? I'm interested especially at the cent and rents, the English I understand. Cent and rents, how much is it? I can see the figure you're talking about, the 30.2 million. It is on page 2. I've read that one. I'm saying you have not been able to tell us out of the 40 billion. You see the 48 billion that was made, that there's irregular expenditure. And you said, in principle, that people are making business with the state, you see that thing. And the breakdown of those figures, you have not been able to pinpoint to us. As you are busy saying there's an improvement, we want to know that in terms of the fiscus, how much was that loss? Then, today, your graph doesn't talk to that, you see. Because we are interested to know exactly who is doing business with government, you see, or with the state, in the new definitions of the gentleman. That's what the Auditor General must guide us about. And that's all the explanation with due respect. I've not heard it, you see. And I'm interested in it, sir.
All right.
That's okay. Where my relationship and you start and end. Kishalet.
Okay.
Brendan, sir.
All right.
I'm sure when we start reporting from 16-17, we'll be giving the full picture of the extent to which officials are trading with the state. Because up to now, we've been compiling the information on the basis of those that are trading with the state in contradictions of the rules that exist. So that is information that we're providing here. So I hope I've answered, because from 16-17, no one is allowed to trade with the to enter into business with the state. So when we report going forward, it should be much bigger numbers, assuming the trends that you've seen. But in the past, we had no particular reason to have to compile the information of everyone who trades with the state, because at the end of the day, as the audit office, our main interest is to report those issues of non-compliance. So if people were trading with the state and is within the law, I don't think it was for necessary, let me put it that way. I hope I'm answering you now fully, member, for us to be tracking that number. So, but there are other elements which sits in our general report that have contributed to that 48 billion rand issue. And as I said, that if it's the environment that allows conflict of interest not to be managed, it's the same environment that can allow significant big ticket items to be missed as far as procurement is concerned. That's the thing that we're flagging. Okay, there's issue about the e-disclosure system. I think that was a comment that we, something I'm sure that we need to be alive to as we continue our audit in this area, that there are issues there. And the issue of where is it in the highlighted in the audit report and in the general report, maybe I think it's a pity I don't have our PFMA general report. I don't know whether you've got one, Sianda, because Maybe the member can give me his email address, and then I can email you the general report and give specific reference where we cover this area. I think in the general report, and we might even send a typical audit report that has where we've raised issues of conflict of interest, so that you can see how it's captured both in the audit report and in the general report. I think
all
that
right.
might be
no,
better
think,
way to
I
do
think
it.
Let's
yeah.
send the information
to the committee.
To
all right,
then,
we'll do. Okay,
then
we'll do that. Yeah.
Distribute it to all members.
Okay, sure. Thank
yeah.
you.
All right, comrades, can we bring this to a close? And just
can I just make one comment?
Yeah.
I think we need to be clear, colleagues, just to our colleagues here. These provisions are not a silver bullet. If I am of corrupt orientation, I can just get a friend outside there to do business with me. This just helps to pick up families and all that sort of thing. The AG will agree that stopping corruption comes down to SEM processes, comes down to the PFMA. This reader has never seen this as a silver bullet that this will solve everything, because there's very easy ways around this. It comes down to the PFMA, it comes down to Treasury regulations, it comes down to SEM processes. That's what stops them. But thank you very much, Chair. I just wanted to make that point.
But, you see, Chair, the worrying part should be in the way he is identifying and dealing with the Act. Luckily, both me and comrade from the Honourable, who sit on the PC, on the Public Administration Committee. The way you are breaking down and you are saying that the President has created this lacuna, this approach of allowing the processing and the regulating of that particular Act is a point of concern, you see, because it then opens us up to not knowing what is the problem, you see. And it does allow elements of this. If the officials now are beginning to determine, we sit down, we craft out, we put up an act, the next thing now is being broken down, that where is it, how to implement it, and how suitable to it certain people, you see. It's a matter of concern, you see. And we should concern ourselves, because it does then say that officials are beginning to be shrewd in how they get the laws to be implemented that could benefit or that could assist us in our fight against any elements of corruption, you see. But it should be worrying Parliament that, I mean, our own officials are beginning to be so shrewd into beginning to determine, after we've really passed a law, that they can then start finding ways of how to implement it so that it doesn't squeeze them out of the system. That should be a worrying way of how that presentation, and how I foresee the problems growing within government themselves if we have to deal with the elements of corruption and fraudulent practices.
All right. Comrades, a few things from me. One, it is to say today's engagement is very important, because it talks to the question of ethics within public administration. Once you have employees who are able to do business with the state, you can then imagine what other things they can do. And this report is actually talking to employees who did not do the declaration when they were supposed to, which is a contravention of existing regulations or the law. Or companies that have employees that gave false declaration, which is fraudulent. And our concern, our interest as Parliament, is to drive towards a clean and ethical administration. We must never say it's still a small fire. Let's wait until it's big. That's when we can call the fire extinguisher. We need to nip it right in the bud. So the concerns and the calls for ethical political leadership must not stop there. We need ethical administrative managers, generally. And from what I've seen here, comrades, I think the Department of Police, Correctional Services, Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, Public Works, Trade and Industry, Department of Public Enterprises. These are the departments that have high amounts in relation to the 2015-2016 financial year only. That, I believe, I'd spoken to the Auditor General before the start of the meeting in terms of the details, that if we say the Department of Police has 14 million, can we be able to get each transaction that says, this is the employee, this is the amount, this is what happened? They said they'll be able to give that to us. So that when we say we're engaging the Department of Police, we're able to say, these are your officials, this is what they did, what have you done to them, why was this allowed to happen? You know. So I think we should be able to have that information. But I also think, comrades, that all the departments that are affected, even if it was 20,000 rand, it's 20,000 rand that should not have happened. I think there's to be a way in which, depending on what we agree, we're still able to communicate to them, even if it's by way of a letter, to explain what happened, what measures have they taken on each of these, and depending on the kind of reports that they give us, we can then decide if there's need for further action. But those that have very high amounts, they must come here and explain themselves. But I also think that the Public Service Commission, the Department of Public Service and Administration, National Treasury, in relation to the commitments they made after the 2008 report, I think there's need to have this kind of engagement to say, where are we? Yes, the Act has been passed, but where are we? Especially with the staggered implementation of the Act from Public Service and Administration, but also PSC, Public Service Commission. What are they doing? What are they saying? If you look at the report, there are specific commitments that they made in 2008 that we're going to do this, we're going to establish this. Have they done those things? And of course, National Treasury. Lastly, I had a discussion yesterday with the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Public Service and Administration, which I do suppose we do need to have much, much closer interaction. Because all the problems we are dealing with as COPA are a result of a not-so-good public service. And yet, that department has a very central responsibility in terms of ensuring that the kind of civil service that the Constitution and the laws require. So how we interact with that portfolio committee, bring them closer, let them have a sense of what we are seeing from our perspective, which would inform part of their work, I think is important. But let us see how we take some of these things forward. But I think would need those details that give us the breakdown, so that we can be able to then make the necessary follow-ups. Right, comrades. Tomorrow it's ESCOM and National Treasury. I think there will be documents that will be supplied to us. As well, tomorrow, from where I'm standing, there are no focus areas. They will come and talk to us, and then we'll take it up from there. Right? Thank you very much, comrades. Till tomorrow.
Yeah.